tonight on Arena. The Deepest Breath, Squaring the Circle, and While We Watched, other movies up for review. And Mark Cousins talks to us about his documentary, My Name is Alfred Hitchcock. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And to film reviews, first on this Thursday evening, three very different documentaries. In The Deepest Breath, Irish filmmaker Laura McGann explores the world of free diving, one of the most dangerous competitive sports. Legendary photographer Anton Corbijn brings us Squaring the Circle, about the creative pair behind the iconic album covers for the likes of Pink Floyd, Peter Gabriel and AC/DC. And a feature documentary from India, While We Watched, which depicts the impact of the campaign of government misinformation against its opposition and against journalists. Deirdre Malumbi and Dave Hanratty have been watching all three films and they're with me in studio now. Let's start with The Deepest Breath, which goes on limited release in cinemas tomorrow and will be available on Netflix from next Wednesday. Earlier this week, I spoke to the Irish filmmaker Laura McGann about her documentary chronicling the journey of two people in the competitive and dangerous world of free diving. That documentary, The Deepest Breath, is released in cinemas tomorrow. For those who don't know, Dave, and I almost shudder when I think about it, just explain once again for me and for others, what is free diving?
It's an extremely terrifying thing. Yeah, it's a deeply competitive thing. Essentially, it's you, if you were a free diver, you would take a deep breath, hence the title of this film. Before submerging yourself in the water, you would travel to the depths of the ocean floor, or as far as you could go. There's usually a target, and you have to do it with that breath. You don't have an oxygen supply. There'll be safety divers with you to ensure that you get back okay to the surface. But it's essentially throwing yourself down into the depths as far as possible with just that one breath.
As I say, even when it's described to me again and having watched the film, you almost hold your breath when you're watching this. It is so terrifying and it is so tense to watch people really risking their lives with every dive, Deirdre.
That's right. And in the span of the documentary, it does interview a number of free diving professionals, and they talk about how even as you go deeper and deeper into the ocean, your lungs are being compressed and everything. So it is quite terrifying. And I mean, the very first shot of The Deepest Breath sees Alicia Vicini, who is the Italian free diver who the documentary kind of primarily follows. And she's just emerged through the surface and she's kind of going into a state of shock. She's about to lose her consciousness. So I think that from a very early stage, it is established just how dangerous this sport is. As well as Alicia, the film primarily follows an Irish safety diver named Stephen Keenan. And even though these two come from very different backgrounds and they have very different stories behind how they each came to the world of free diving, they just share this absolute passion for it. It's a world that seems kind of intoxicating. They both absolutely adore this sport.
And I asked this of Laura McGann the other night when I was speaking to her, even as I was watching it, I was thinking, are we glorifying this, you know, life-risking activity? Is there a balance here between the kind of the risks that are taking and the safety elements around it? How does Laura McGann strike that particular, because that's an ethical problem for me, showing something like this without pointing out the, or I suppose making entertainment out of what is a very dangerous activity.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of ethical concerns, I think, with this kind of thing. And there's some I have myself, not necessarily in that direction, though, because, and I did going in, though, I kind of was like, well, you know, is this reckless? I mean, like if I knew somebody and if someone I loved was doing this, would I be trying to make them stop doing it? But I do think, as Dee says, the very first thing that you see after the submerging, you know, you see the physical reaction that can happen to you in what they refer to as a blackout, where you are going into that kind of shock and it is a case of your life is on the line. So I think seeing that image, because it's not pretty.
Like no, it's not. There's people with bulging eyes and they are effectively, the brain has cut itself off. It's a safety mechanism that the brain does.
It's genuinely shocking, and that's there throughout. But I do think as well, not so much, there is a degree of glorification, but this is about chasing glory. This is about becoming immortal.
And also becoming a, you know, pushing yourself to the limits, because if human beings don't push themselves to the limits, how do we improve and improve and improve and better things?
Yeah, and it should also be said that these people are like really like they're athletes. Like it's not just, you know, like throwing yourself down there like on a whim.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot that goes into doing this, and you have to be made of extremely tough stuff mentally and physically to do it.
Let's have a listen to a clip from it, from the documentary, and this is where they're describing the blue hole. And the blue hole is one of the tasks that Alessia, the Italian freediver, she really wants to complete this task, but it's very dangerous and lots of people have been killed while attempting to make their way through this blue hole. Let's have a listen to the description of what is involved.
Steve just fell in love with freediving, and especially the blue hole. You literally walk from the beach into an abyss, like there is this gaping hole in the coral reef, which really, like, wants you to go down there. And then there's this arch, like a chapel on the water. Unfortunately, it also has a bad reputation. It took lives.
This is the most dangerous dive site on Earth. It's thought to have claimed over 100 lives.
In terms of fatalities, the blue hole is even more perilous than Mount Everest. As well as myself, there's only been a handful of people who have freedived through it. Natalia Molchanova was the only woman to do it.
So that's a clip from the documentary film The Deepest Breath, and several free divers there are speaking about the task that is involved in trying to dive through this particular area undersea, the blue hole. So the danger here is very explicit, and it's made quite explicit, and there are great concerns around the safety of the whole affair as well. And that side of the story is told. But the look of the film is something else, Deirdre.
Oh, it's absolutely so, so beautiful. The underwater footage, which is taken from actual divers, is just really extraordinary, particularly when we're peering into that still and calming and yet eerie and threatening world that does, you know, lie beneath ocean surfaces. There's incredible access in the documentary as well. We're interviewing professionals in the free diving world, but also friends, family and journalists. There's a lot of personal archival footage from Stephen's adventures, Alicia's competitions, etc., which are kind of interspliced into it. So it's a really gorgeous looking film, because as well as kind of the underwater eerie footage, you see, you know, Stephen and Alicia just talking to camera, you know, little videos that they took on their phone, just hanging out and stuff like that. Like, it's really quite beautiful and multi-layered, the story, as well as you having kind of that competitive and the sport aspect to it. It's also the story of a friendship and of, you know, kind of pushing what humanity can achieve.
Yeah, because it would seem as if they're both great subjects for documentaries. Alicia, in terms of really wanting to push herself to the absolute limits, and then whenever she met up with Steve Keenan, the Irish safety expert and diving instructor, there was some kind of connection between the two of them. And it wasn't just, it had the smell of a romantic connection okay off it, but it really was about somehow they both just suited each other at that moment in time. It was like fate almost meant for them to come together in terms of free diving, Dave.
Yeah, no, it feels like destiny. It really does. It feels like these two people from different parts of the world, different backgrounds, were meant to come together in many respects. And yeah, the spark of romance, even beyond that. Like, I mean, I think at one stage she has a line where she says, "He's the only one who could coach me. He was the only one who could do it." Like, because like they ended up working together on this event, and then from there it went. But a documentary is often only as interesting as the people in it. You know, it's like, and these two people I thought were incredibly compelling in very different ways.
Now, there is another issue here, and want to be very careful about what I say about this. For most of the film, we get archival footage of the two main subjects, and we hear both their fathers speaking about them in wonderful, glowing terms, and very moving to hear.
As fathers do.
Yeah, very moving to hear the two fathers doing just that.
Yeah.
There's a structural way that Laura McGann tells the story here. Is it problematic? We can't say too much about, you know, the outcome of the film, but is it problematic?
It's hard, yeah. I do feel like I'm kind of tiptoeing here. Mm. It has been kind of, you know, noted even when, you know, you watch trailers for this documentary and stuff, that there is kind of an element of tragedy to this story. It's hinted at throughout, and I think the movie does a really good job at concealing exactly how events are going to turn out until, I think, what is just the right moment. I mean, for me personally watching it, I thought that it felt fitting and that the emotional weight of the story was really felt because of when that moment happens.
The way you were told.
So I understand what you mean about the ethical concerns, but I actually think that that added more gravitas to the story, the way that she chose to tell it. I thought that she did the right thing.
It could be argued as well, though, Dave, couldn't it, that, you know, your emotions are exploited?
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, this film treads a very dangerous line of sensitivity, as dangerous as a freediving event, really, because, again...
Well, although we're not putting our lives at risk to watch it.
Well, no, we're not. Although it is incredibly immersive, and yeah. If you're claustrophobic or anything, you're like, wow. Again, I would echo that the footage is incredible.
Yeah.
But yes, there's an issue, and again, without, you know, going too far here in terms of the narrative, because I think it's clear, though, even if you go in knowing nothing about these people, that, you know, something is going to
happen.
Something bad
is going to happen.
That's also like, it's just familiar in terms of documentary construction or film construction. You know, it's leading to a thing, and the thing isn't probably not going to be amazing. But essentially, I think we need to have a conversation about ethical construction and emotional manipulation when it comes to this kind of thing, because it's not just tugging on your heartstrings. It's making a symphony out of it.
Yeah, but I mean, it tells us the truth. It may hold off on when it tells us the truth. And good storytelling is about, you know, telling the right bit at the right time. Do we need to have a different consideration for storytelling methods for documentaries than we do for pieces of fiction?
I think it depends on the subject matter, but I do think that this is just on the right line of respect. And I think it does the job that it should do. Even I should say as well, like, even with these concerns swirling through my brain while I was watching this, where it goes and how it goes there, it knocked me out. Like,
very
I was
moving.
Sobbing in the cinema, you know, like proper, like leaving the screening and just drying my eyes. Like, it really is hugely emotional for so many reasons, and it's because of those people involved.
Yeah.
But there's just sometimes where you're like, you know, I wonder if this is entirely appropriate.
Yeah, I suppose the story could have been told differently and it would have had a different impact. And Dave saying there about in the cinema, you're saying, Deirdre, in the cinema is the place to see it. I know it's going to be
absolutely
on Netflix.
You have to see it in the cinema. Yeah, I do. My understanding is it's on Netflix actually on Friday week, but it is a movie that is made for the big screen. So if you can see it, do see it there.
Okay, well, it's on unlimited release in cinemas from tomorrow. I'll hold off on the other Netflix bit for just a moment. But that's when you can see it in the cinemas. We'll come back to the other aspect of it later. Stars from you on this one, Deirdre?
I've got to give it 4 stars. I think that it's extraordinary. It's moving. It's heartbreaking. And it's really haunting. We were both properly shook when we left that screening. And it does stay with you long after viewing. I've been thinking about it ever since.
Hardened old hacks crying in the cinema. Dave?
Oh, I'm an easy touch, though. I'm an emotional guy. 3.5 for me, bordering on 4. I would echo what was said there, but I would say those concerns are kind of swirling in my head.
Right.
But it has stuck with me, and I do think it's an incredible story.
Right. The Deepest Breath, the title of the first of our documentaries this evening. Let's move on then to Squaring the Circle from Anton Corbin. It tells the story of Hypnosis, a creative outfit made up of Audrey Powell and Storm Thorgerson. Together, they were responsible for some of the most iconic vinyl designs that the music industry has ever seen, made up of interviews with Aubrey, who's also known as Poe, and friends of Hypnosis, as well as archival footage. The film centres around the relationship between the two men and looks back at a time of flourishing creativity. I suppose it is the album cover, kind of a thing of the past, really. But at the point at which this film is set, the period of time that we're in, Dave, the album cover was a hugely important thing. But these two guys at the centre of it, Storm Thorgerson and Aubrey Powell, how did the friendship start? Because, I mean, there's a kind of I don't know how you describe the kind of loyalty that started to exist between them after a peculiar event.
Yeah, it's a wayward youth situation. I think the 16-year-old Aubrey Powell went to a house party and there were lots and lots of drugs available at the house party and all kinds of things. Storm Thorgerson was there as well. I think it might have been his place, where he was certainly living there at the time. Mm. He was slightly older. I think he's 4 years older. And the police come along, you're ruining everyone's fun. Everyone runs and flees the scene. Storm is staying behind because, as we will learn, he's quite a defiant soul. Aubrey Powell makes a decision on the spot to stay with him. He doesn't want to leave this guy who he's just met, and he's asked, why? Why did you stay? And he says he didn't believe in going leaving someone to go down with the ship by themselves.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, these two became absolutely inseparable throughout the rest of their lives.
And creatively, when did they work? That's obviously there was loyalty involved in that, albeit in dubious enough circumstances, it has to be said, Deirdre.
Yeah.
But when did they then discover their creative symbiosis, which they seem to have?
Yeah, so Storm and Poe were eventually approached by their friends in what would become Pink Floyd to design the cover for the group's second album, which is called A Saucer Full of Secrets. And from there, they pretty much went on to do all of the major album designs for the band, including perhaps their most iconic one, which is, you know, Dark Side of the Moon, which we have seen visions of on many occasions. And then they went on to design for the likes of, I mean, the list of credits here is incredible. Def Leppard, T-Rex, Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, Paul McCartney and Wings. The list just goes on and on. And I think what's really interesting about Hypnosis was that they were kind of both reflecting, but they were also kind of creating this zeitgeist in which music was really considered art, and the graphic designs that they were creating reinforced that idea.
Yeah, let's listen to, this is Poe, Aubrey Powell, explaining how they created their very first album cover for Pink Floyd.
Storm had the idea. He said, oh, let's take a picture out of this alchemical book. Let's take a picture out of a Marvel comic of Doctor Strange. Let's do this, let's do that. Okay. I got the Pentax and I shot these things all in black and white. Processed the film, went in the darkroom and started to create through the enlarger by shielding off different parts of the paper and then changing the negative and then doing it again and then this montage of pictures. There were dozens of different versions, but then there was one that just singed out. So then I knew how to hand tint and hand color. But there was pressure from the record company to actually have a picture of the band somewhere. We then went to Hampstead Pond, where we photographed the band in infrared film. And we placed a little picture of the band in infrared in there from that session. And that was the very, very first album cover, really, that we did.
That's Aubrey Powell there, or Poe, in a scene from the documentary Squaring the Circle. And that was the description of how himself and Storm Sorgerson went about designing the first album cover that they did for Pink Floyd. What's the dynamic between the two men? I mean, Aubrey Powell sounds like quite a congenial fella there, really, doesn't he?
He's a great host in this, and you got a lot of good talking heads here, including, like, you know, people from Led Zeppelin. You got Paul McCartney, you got Noel Gallagher, who's even more charming than usual in this, I would say. How is their dynamic? It's very interesting because, like, Poe is essentially a photographer. He falls in love with photography. Storm Thorgerson is a graphic designer. So they were the roles, essentially.
Yeah.
But, I mean, kind of like very brotherly, I would say, with the occasional scrap. Storm in particular is this painted as, like, everyone at one stage says he was the rudest man. He was the rudest person ever. There's an incredible line someone has where they say he's the kind of man who won't take yes for an answer, which I love. I'm stealing that line going forward. So, yeah, I think Powell is more the kind of velvet glove to Thorgerson's iron fist, but they complemented each other. They accentuated each other's strengths and they were really, really incredible together. And what they did, I mean, it should be said, like, I mean, they're kind of geniuses in a way. And, like, as you said at the top of this, a different time, the album artwork meant so much more. Noel Gallagher has a great rant about how his kid didn't understand what artwork was because it's just a little thumbnail on their Spotify or whatever these days. And he's like, well, yeah, but it costs like $100,000 for me, like in a meeting I'm in all day. It meant so much more, the physical nature of all this and what they were doing. They had all these crazy vivid ideas and they cost a lot of money to make and they charged a lot of money for their services too. So
yeah, they weren't afraid. They weren't going to price themselves out of the market. We've heard the kind of congeniality, as I said, of Aubrey Powell. Let's listen to Storm Thorgerson describing himself.
I was described by some as difficult to work with, by others as a ponce, by some as a narcissist with an ego the size of a small planet, by some as really awkward, argumentative, by others yet as grumpy. Very few as handsome and sexy, which of course is the way I see myself.
I mean, is he playing with us? I mean, it sounds as if he was quite difficult to work with, but maybe he's difficult to work with because he wanted to get the very best result.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because you can hear in that the sense of humour that he has. And I think that that was what
quite
was quite...
Yeah,
and I think that that's something that really Hypnosis kind of infused into their work was a sense of humour. Like, they tell some stories like the people might remember Atom Heart Mother by Pink Floyd. The album cover for that was just a cow. And basically, the band wanted to have something totally random and meaningless, so they just went out to a field and shot a picture of a cow. And there's another story in which they had an album cover that involved this giant inflatable floating pig that managed to escape. And they're able to kind of look at these albums, and as much as they're talking about, you know, the serious of the artwork and stuff like that, they really are trying to have a bit of a laugh.
Knock the fun out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But and you've touched on it, Dave, already. Is this really for somebody who knows the music of the era that we're talking about? I suppose we're really in the 70s, 80s, even a bit earlier, 60s, 70s, 80s. Is it for people who... It's a dad rock period, let's face it. Is it for people who love that type of music and know that music really well? Or can you come to this with little or no knowledge of the period?
Yeah, it's of course, you will definitely get more if you are an ardent fan of this kind of thing. And the dad rock thing is spot on. I said to someone, I was like, oh, like when this pops up in BBC Four in a few years on a Friday night, your dad's going to love it. But I should say, as someone, and I'm, like, I'm a music journalist, but to my shame, I'm not that into Pink Floyd. I'm not that into Led Zeppelin. So I kind of went into this with a bit of, oh no, am I going to be really outside here and just be like, you know, kind of like, is this just for anoraks? No, I thought it was incredibly engaging from the word go. It is a fascinating time in music, even if you don't have the vinyls yourself in your collection. And like I said at the top as well, Aubrey Powell is a wonderful storyteller. I could have listened to another hour of him just talking about his life because it's quite fascinating. Mm. The Talking Heads are great. And yeah, I mean, like, just from an educational point of view, I came away like with lots of new information I didn't have before. And it's told in a very interesting way. There's lots of wry commentary. Yeah, it's just, it moves, this thing. It really, really does.
And I've decided not to ask either of you to explain why it's spelled Hypnosis with a G. It's a hip... I can't even say it, but it's to do with Gnosticism, G-N-Gnosticism. Yes. Do you want to try to explain what the link there, or is there really a link, Deirdre?
I don't know if I'll attempt that because I literally just got the fact that it was called Squaring the Circle was in reference to the vinyl albums, like when I was out for a walk in the park the other day. So these things always go over my head.
Yeah, I don't think it's essential to the understanding and enjoyment of the film, but it sounds from both of you that, yeah, I mean, even as we're talking about it, you were both had a great laugh at this essentially arty documentary, but that had knocks a bit of fun out of it.
That's just it. And I mean, there's such a like degree of warmth and nostalgia in all the interview subjects as they're kind of reflecting on this idealistic past, but also in all the stories that emerge about all of these like album covers. Like, there are some absolutely crazy, hilarious things that they do. They fly out to Hawaii to shoot an album cover which involves a sheep on a psychiatrist's chair by the sea. And in the end, the final album has this teeny tiny picture of the sheep that they took. It's just, it's absolutely bonkers. But I mean, you know, I think that us Irish viewers, we love a good comedy. This is as much a comedy as it is a documentary.
It's kind
I think.
Of a father Ted, the father Ted of album covers.
Yeah.
Stars from you, Deirdre.
I'd have to give this 4 stars because I just had so much fun watching this. Those album designs are absolutely iconic. I think even if you're not, you know, very familiar with the music industry, you're going to recognize at least a few. And the labor, the creativity and the fun that went into them really do stay with you.
Stars.
4.
And what are you saying, Dave?
It's 3.5 because it kind of ends in a weirdly abrupt note. Quite a downbeat one as well. And I felt there was more story to tell. A little bit more, like I kind of wanted a bit more from just where the guys ended up, you know, in their own respective lives when the boom of this was over. And I think it lacks a little bit of self-critique. I think it's kind of like everything they did
was brilliant.
Incredible. Yeah, yeah, it's just like everything, no notes, you know, like everything is amazing. It's wonderful. Even if you're like, well, that one's pretty naff. Like, I mean, you know, flying a statue to the top of a mountain for a Wings album cover, it's, you know, not for me, mate. But I mean, it is incredibly engaging, and I think you could go in having zero knowledge of the or appreciation for the time period and still come away being like, that was really good. Anton Corbin shoots it beautifully in black and white, and again, I can't say it enough, Aubrey Powell, if he doesn't have a podcast, he should have one. He's really interesting.
All right. And what you said,
three and a half.
Okay, fairly solid star ratings from both of you there then for Squaring the Circle. I will admit that when you've just explained the title to me as well, Deirdre, so thank you for that. Finally, we turn our attention to the Indian documentary, which charts the misinformation campaign undertaken by Narendra Modi's nationalist government against its opponents. While We Watched is the title of the film. A newsroom-based film focuses on the work of a broadcast journalist called Ravish Kumar, who finds himself in the government firing line. Give us the setup here. I suppose you need to talk about the media world in India, which is not that different from the media world anywhere else, Dave.
Yeah, this is all about misinformation and kind of, you know, the main journalist at the heart of this, Ravish Kumar, is essentially someone who is more on the left side of politics, and he uses his show to speak common sense to the people watching it and to challenge the government, very anti-establishment. But he's also reflective of a very, you know, difficult time in that kind of journalism where, like, his newsroom is dwindling. You know, they don't even have incredible equipment. People are leaving. And meanwhile, the more right-wing news networks, which look like GB News and Fox News, just in India, are so much more aggressive, so much more flash in terms of their presentation. And this is essentially about people being radicalized through news media, misinformation, how social media has changed the game, and how someone like Ravish Kumar, does he even matter anymore, and can he get through to people?
Let's have a listen to a clip, which is a montage from different TV journalists, I suppose, laying out their views on nationalism and journalism.
I say today, it is time to bring down this last standing bastion of people who see nationalism as an insult, a burden.
Is nationalism the only way forward for journalism in India? The NDTV group is now facing a public and a corporate boycott. They are being investigated for financial fraud, leaving them on the verge of shutdown.
The battle lines will have to be drawn even harder now between us and them.
And that's a clip from the documentary While We Watched. The lead, I suppose, the subject of this documentary is Ravish Kumar. Mm-hmm. What kind of person are we talking about there, and how dangerous a situation is he in?
Very dangerous, I would say. I mean, the film is kind of punctuated throughout with these phone calls that he's getting constantly on his phone. These phone calls will involve harassment, intimidation, and even death threats in some cases. So it's quite frightening in that way. And it's quite interesting because, you know, Kumar is kind of telling us about how he and his team are really striving for research and evidence-based journalism. But he himself isn't totally objective either. And he makes his disdain for the ruling establishment very clear, and he's very public about it on, you know, on these live news broadcasts. At one point in the film, there is a terrorist attack which kills 40 soldiers in the Kashmir region. And while the public are kind of crying out, you know, death to Pakistanis, he's urging the public to be sympathetic towards the families involved and also to not turn towards violence. Yeah. And at this point in the film, he gets even more phone calls and he starts to engage with them as well.
And one other aspect of this is there's a lot assumed. There's a lot of information around the Indian-Pakistan situation and the Kashmir region, but we're not given any context for any of that, Dave.
I'm curious if this was meant for an international audience, because this is a documentary about journalism, about the importance of conveying information, and I was quite stunned that it's lacking basic information. Like, if you were in this documentary, you would expect the name Sean Rocks to pop up while you're speaking. In a lot of cases, that doesn't happen.
And so you don't know who's talking or what particular angle they're coming from.
I wasn't sure what time period we were in at first, and there's very little, there's no background given. Like, if you don't have international knowledge of this situation, you'll have to Google it afterwards, kind of thing.
Stars from you, Div.
Three, because of that lacking in context, but I found it a very interesting insight into modern day journalism. Ravish Kumar was quite interesting, and it is also a very depressing thing to just see that these right wing tactics are actually very effective.
And from you, Stars, dear?
Yeah, I also found it quite dense, and sometimes it didn't quite dive into the politics and issues as I would have liked to see. Also, the wider issues feel insurmountable, and I couldn't help that it felt a bit bleak at times. And yet, because of that lack of information, I'd also have to give it 3 stars. But a fascinating insight into that country.
Fascinating nonetheless. Okay, that's our final documentary. So just to give you the sense of what we've been talking about, The Deepest Breath goes on limited release in cinemas from tomorrow, holding off and telling you about Netflix from Wednesday, because you should see it in the cinema, Deirdre says, but it is on Netflix from next Wednesday. Squaring the Circle opens in selected cinemas, including the IFI, the Lighthouse and the Paul House in Galway. And While We Watched also goes on limited release from tomorrow. Dave Hanratty and Deirdre Malumbi are reviewers on this Thursday evening. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena.
Parties. I used to love to party in the old days.
That was the new single from the all-conquering CMAT featuring another former guest of Arena, the one and only John Grant. The song is called Where Are Your Kids Tonight? The video is magnificent, real 80s throwback, well worth a look. Now, from next week, you may have heard that we will be at the earlier time of 6:30 with Arena. We'll be here 6:30 through to 7:30, and this will all link in with our coverage from Galway of the Galway International Arts Festival, which runs from July the 17th through until the 30th. We will broadcast two shows from there in the first week, July the 20th and July the 21st. But then in the second week of the festival, we're heading back down to Galway for a special event on Thursday, July the 27th, an audience with Druid Theatre Company at the Town Hall Theatre. All about Druid O'Casey, the three plays of Sean O'Casey's Dublin trilogy, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman, Juno and the Paycock, will be performed. And on Thursday, July the 27th at 3 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre, we will be joined by the creative team behind Druid O'Casey, director Gary Hines, and cast of the play will be there as well, Catherine Walsh, Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Fay and Zara Devlin. You can be part of that event if you want to attend on Thursday, July the 27th between 3 and 4 p.m. Go to druid.ie for full details and we would be delighted to have you with us in the Town Hall Theatre Company for an Arena Druid O'Casey special from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, Thursday, July 27th, 3 p.m. druid.ie for details on how to get tickets. My Name Is Alfred Hitchcock is the title of a new film from Northern Irish director Mark Cousins. In the film, we hear Alfred Hitchcock speaking from the vantage point of the 21st century, looking back on his career, how he directed individual scenes from his films, and the various themes that he explored throughout his entire body of work. I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Cousins on the line right now. I have to say, Mark, when I saw practically immediately, I think it's maybe the second or third caption we see, written and voiced by Alfred Hitchcock, my excitement was on high.
You were I know.
You were playing with me.
Playing with you, you know, that was the idea. You know, Hitchcock played with us, and so I wanted to play with you as well. You know, I wanted to sort of get you to believe that Hitchcock is talking to us now, 43 years after he died.
And so you had to find a way of getting Hitchcock's voice. Now, I'm sure there's lots of archive recordings of him talking and saying possibly many of the things that we hear said in the film. But you went a different route.
Yes, you know, I didn't want to use, you know, interviews of Hitchcock, you know, because I wanted to be free in a way to really think, reimagine what he would say now, not when he was alive, you know. So I just sat here at my desk and kind of wrote like almost like I sort of imagined a monologue from Hitchcock. I wanted to ask, you know, Hitchcock made films in the 50s, 60s, etc. But what would he think of today's world and today's cinema and today's fears? And so that's why I've written this kind of new way of looking at Hitchcock, hopefully.
And there's so much has been written, obviously, about Alfred Hitchcock over the years. And he wasn't a man who was afraid to talk about his own work. I mean, when we think of the famous television programmes where he topped and tailed them himself, you know, setting us up for the programme we were about to see. How much of what you imagined did you adjust in some of Alfred Hitchcock's own words, or is it all your writing?
I was slightly daunted, you know, because, as you say, so much has been said and done about Hitchcock. But I just thought, you know, you have to be confident and fearless. And so everything that you hear in this film is my own writing. There's nothing verbatim from Hitchcock. Mm. But nearly everything he says is based on some fact or some interview that he gave. So it's very close to the contours of the real Hitchcock. This is a very, I think, true picture of Hitchcock, but it's filtered through a number of things, like, you know, today rather than then. Mm. And I made this film during, you know, lockdown, the COVID time, and so I think it's slightly filtered through what it felt like to be in COVID as well.
So you're giving us the words on the page. You have to get them then off the page and into some sort of voiceover recording. There was a task for you to do. Who did you call upon to help with that task?
Well, exactly. You know, lots of people have played Hitchcock, you know, very famous actors with differing degrees of success, I have to say. You know, some of them did it brilliantly and some not. But I needed somebody to do Hitchcock's voice brilliantly. So I'm lucky enough to know Simon Callow, the great actor. And I emailed him and I said, look, who can do Hitchcock? And he said, the best ear in the business, not the best actor, the best ear in the business is Alistair McGowan, who some people might remember, you know, from his days as an impersonator. He's also an actor. He's a musician. He plays the piano. And so the first stop was we emailed Alistair's agent and we heard nothing and heard nothing and heard nothing. And then my phone went and it was a voicemail from Alistair. And I just felt as if I was hearing Hitchcock. So right from the start, I think that he got the cadence, the complexity, the humor of Hitchcock exactly right. And I cried.
But it was that voicemail. So he came on in Hitchcock, in full Hitchcock performance mode.
Yes. Full Hitchcock performance. Yeah. You know, and it was just great. And I phoned my producer and said, search is over. You know, he was the first person we asked and the only person we asked. He was so good. And I've worked with Jane Fonda and Tilda Swinton and some of the great people in cinema, but to see Alistair McGowan, you know, really take on the voice, like he would sort of drop his throat down like this and, you know, I'd bring phlegm up into his mouth. And to see somebody who's really, really good at what they do was great, you know. And we recorded the whole film and it's 2 hours long, you know. We recorded the whole film in like basically a cupboard on the border between England and Wales. And he made no fluffs. No mistakes. I would love to say that I directed him a lot to come up with this voice performance, but not at all. He was just effort. He was just Hitchcock.
Let's have a listen to a clip. And this is that there are 6 chapters in total. It's kind of laid out like a book in that respect. And the first of the chapters deals with escapes and how they fit into the films of Alfred Hitchcock. And the first film that we're going to hear, Hitchcock himself, as you tell us in the opening credits, talking about here is Madeline, of course, in the 39 Steps. And you'll hear how the theme of escape fits into things there.
And a long lens works for us in this little bit of business. Madeline is handcuffed to a man who might be a killer. She painfully pulls out her hand and so can escape. Except, well, even in his sleep, he won't let her go. Earlier in the picture, Robert Donat had swapped clothes with his milkman to escape his apartment block unrecognised. Put on my little hat. There you are. How we used shadows back then.
You do the same for me one day.
But then I'm getting out. In To Catch a Thief, Carey undresses to escape.
Well, nobody will ever recognise me in these.
Now, this was a far more colourful world than the 39 Steps, but Carey and Robert both have that delicious lightness of touch. I'm sure you remember his escape here. He's not in swimming trunks, of course, though some of you might have liked that.
A clip there from the film My Name is Alfred Hitchcock with Alfred Hitchcock, or Alistair McGowan, giving us the voice of Alfred Hitchcock, talking about the theme of escapes in his own films. Mark Cousins, director, writer and director of the film, is with me this evening on Arena. It really is, what Alistair McGowan does there, it really is a performance of Hitchcock. It isn't an impersonation. It's beyond that.
I agree with that. You know, I think that, you know, it's easy to impersonate, and now in the era of AI technology, you could get a computer to, in some way, you know, replicate the cadences of Hitchcock. But what Alistair McGowan does, because he's a proper actor, you know, and he sees the comedy in something and the emotion in something, and his unusual phrasing. Like when I was standing in that booth listening to him to do that scene, I was surprised where he put the pauses, you know, and those surprises are what you want from an actor. You write something and then to see it more than brought alive is a lovely, lovely thing.
Of course, I mean, that it's a very important part of the film, and it kind of, it's not, you couldn't call it a MacGuffin, but it's almost a kind of technique that Hitchcock himself would have used in the telling of a story.
I think so, because Hitchcock was so playful, right? We know, in nearly all his films, he underplays the tragedy with the comedy. So I wanted to be a bit playful as well.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it is it's not distracting. You don't spend your whole time saying, "Oh, that's a brilliant impersonation of Hitchcock." You do actually listen to what has been said, which are your words. So that theme of escape, Mark. I mean, it is the one that is. It takes up, I think, a fair chunk, probably the biggest chunk of the film of all of the different themes that you explore. I know you were writing this during lockdown, so that may have been part of it. But do you think it is the major theme in the films of Hitchcock?
I don't know. I wanted to avoid the other things that have been said about Hitchcock because they've been said so well. So I don't know if it's a major theme, but if you think about escape as not only escape in the conventional sense, like I'm bored with my life, I want to get out, I get away from something, but Hitchcock also wanted to escape from the conventions of filmmaking. How did other people do it, and how do I do it differently? So if it's escape from the world, but also from stylistic conventions as well, then that becomes quite rich for me. So that's why I spent a chunk of time on that theme, I think.
Moving on from that theme of escape, the other thing that struck me in terms of doing this film, I'm kind of astonished how early, it's the centenary of the first film of Alfred Hitchcock, 1922, was the first film that he made. The amount of work that you much and films that you must have watched. Do you think you have watched every single Hitchcock film at this point?
Oh yes, I definitely have. We all remember the COVID time, and we had a lot of time in our hands, So I thought I'll watch all 53 films in order, and I don't know, like some people will agree with this who are listening, but I knew that during the COVID times, I was desperate for structure, because there was a danger that days ran into weeks, ran into months. So I thought, if I get up in the morning and I have to watch 2 or 3 Hitchcock films a day, that was great for me, So I did. So I spent roughly a month watching them all. That was enjoyable in itself, but also how often in your life will you get time to do that? And so I was scribbling as I watched these films, and the film that I've made came out of that really quite quickly.
And indeed, later on in the film, the narration tells us that only the most ardent of fans will have seen Juno and the Peacock.
Juno and the Peacock. Yes.
When did he make that, and what class of a realization of Occasey was it?
Juno and the Peacock was made really early, like 1930, and this is not long after Juno and the Peacock premiered on the stage, so this was really early in after the play, but it's not Hitchcock's best film, and I think what I would say is that I didn't get to see a really good version of it. The version that I saw of Juno and the Peacock has got bad sounds, like an old VHS tape or something. So if it hasn't been restored in Ireland, hopefully it has, but if it hasn't, then somebody should get onto that, because maybe this is a better film than we think. It's not awful. I think it's not great, but if we could restore it properly in Ireland, then we have an opportunity to ask, maybe Hitchcock made a really good Irish film.
There you go. It certainly was news on me, and was just interesting to see it happening on the screen.
little
nugget of it. Moving on to one of the other themes, there are several themes that you look at: loneliness, time, fulfillment. But the second chapter, if you like, of the film deals with the whole idea of desire. Let's listen to a clip from Spellbound, which starred Gregory Peck and Ingrid Bergman. And at one stage in the movie, following their case, we see a series of doors opening one after another. And this also happens in Vertigo in Spring. We see Jimmy Stewart's first sight of Kim Novak. Let's listen to the clip from the film that describes those two films.
spellbound as about two people with barriers. Their emotions were behind those barriers, disguised by them. But when they got really close, the force field broke through the barriers. Was I naive way back in the 1940s to film desire as doors opening? I don't think so. Doesn't that still happen sometimes if you get as close to someone as beautiful as Ingrid or Gregory? Oh, my little metaphor still pertains. I think I was trying to show that at a moment of desire, you let go. You lose your grip a little. When Jimmy first sees Kim in Vertigo, I wanted you to feel part of him, leave his body, drift towards her back, that emerald green sash. Our costume designer, Edith Head, used clothes to make a force field. You see, he grows an inch. Do you feel that you're inside his head? His brain is flooded, blooded. Instead of part of him floating to her, she floats to him.
Another clip there from the film. My name is Alfred Hitchcock, and Mark Cousins, writer and director, is with me this evening speaking about the film. Doors were one thing that struck me in what he does across several themes. Another one that you pick up on, Mark, later on and in other films is stairs and ladders and, you know, the floors, if you like, of a building. He really does use visuals to tell us stories that they almost... He tells us subliminally. He's not fond of the words, in fact, in his films, you could argue.
I think that's right. You know, I think that he was not a literary filmmaker. You know, he famously said that he did not want to photograph people talking. You know, he believed strongly. You know, he was broadly a Freudian. You know, he believed that we had an unconscious life and it was either, you know, down in the cellar of our imaginations or in the room next door, and we had to open a door to get in there. So that's why, as you say, there are lots of thresholds, there are doors and ladders and a lot of his pictures, you know, trying to say, okay, let's go into the thing that we don't really admit about ourselves. You know, he was great at that. You know, his films are full of gorgeous people like, you know, Grace Kelly in a cocktail frock or, you know, Cary Grant or something. But he's trying to say, right next door, if you open a door, we'll see their desires, their unconscious life. And so he uses visuals, as you say correctly, the whole way through his career.
One thing that I noticed you didn't go down into, because obviously when we hear the name of Hitchcock, often the conversation turns quite quickly to his treatment of his actors, his female performers in particular, people like Tippi Hedren. Mm-hmm. You don't go down that route at all. You don't get into anything outside of the films, except for in the last section you do talk about the role of Alma, his wife, in his life. But you don't go down that other route. Why did you not go there, Mark?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm a passionate feminist, and you probably know in some of my career I've not only highlighted the great female directors, but called out men who have been terrible, you know. And what Hitchcock did to Tippi Hedren, he was in The Birds and Marnie, was terrible. And she writes about that in her memoir, and it was terrible. And the question is, you know, there were loads of rumors after he died, particularly from the tabloid press, talking about him as what used to be called a dirty old man, you know. But the question is there evidence that he treated other women badly in his career? And I have to say the answer is no. Hitchcock, like more than most male directors of his time, had loads of female collaborators, writers, producers, etc. And they were great experiences, you know, and if you look at their memoirs, they talk about that. I was lucky enough to be friends with Janet Leigh, you know, who was in Psycho, and Teresa Wright, who was in Shadow of the Doubt, and they, I asked them about this, you know, I said, you know, was he creepy? And they said, not to me, he wasn't. You know, he was great. You know, if you look at Ingrid Bergman, loved him. You know, Carol Lombard loved him. The, you know, his female collaborators loved him. So there are lots of rumors about Hitchcock, and we don't want to be people who are just spreading unsubstantiated rumors. We acknowledge hugely that he treated Tippi badly, but we cannot spread rumors if they're untrue about anything else that he did. You know, I'm listening for evidence all the time, but I heard no other evidence that he treated other women badly.
Mark Cousins talking to us there about his new film, My Name is Alfred Hitchcock, which is at selected cinemas from next week. And just picking up on the fact that Mark Cousins' film, My Name is Alfred Hitchcock, will be at selected cinemas from next week. Of course, next week, as I told you, we will be at the earlier time of half past six here on RTE Radio 1. We will be reviewing My Name is Alfred Hitchcock along with the other two huge releases of next week, Greta Gerwig's Barbie with Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie and Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer starring, among others, Cillian Murphy. We will be reviewing those films next week, but it will be on Friday evening. That's on the Friday the 21st when we're broadcasting from Galway. In fact, film reviews for next week will be on Friday the 21st, and for the week after will be on Friday the 28th because of our visit down to Galway for the Druid O'Casey event that we have and that I've told you about earlier in the programme as well. And let me tell you a little bit about tomorrow night's programme. Queen's debut album was released 50 years ago this week. We will be looking at that self-titled album with Pat Carty. We'll also be speaking to the Glasgow-born crime writer Denise Mina, one of the leading lights of the so-called tartan noir movement. She is yet another to write a Philip Marlowe mystery, and she'll be talking to us about that novel tomorrow evening on the programme, and that along with our album reviews, Mahalia, Rita Ora and Sam Barton. That's what we will be doing on Friday night's Arena. In the meantime, let me tell you that this evening Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. The researchers were Paula Shields and Amandine Passo-Devine. Aisling Grufferty was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.